Mini episode 88 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Outside the Box Score, your home on the web for entertaining sports columns and videos. Follow them on the web at outsidetheboxscore.blogspot.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 88. This is Rick Morris from the FDH Lounge coming at you here today. We have a very, very special guest. We're very psyched to do this today, and incredibly so. We are the show, of course, where nothing is off topic, but we've got a soft spot in our heart for pro wrestling from day one. We've been fortunate to have on a number of great guests lined up, as this one was, by our senior producer, the FDH New York Bureau, Steve Servillo. While I'm mentioning folks, I'd also like to mention our great friend Russ Cohen from Sportsology, making this platform available to us yet again for a guest discussion here. We've greatly enjoyed getting to do this over the last several months. We thank Russ tremendously for his help in that regard. But as I was saying, we like having on really any of our interesting guests. We've been fortunate enough to have the giants in a number of different fields, Bob Barker, Tommy Lasorda, Steve Perry. When you're looking at the field of pro wrestling, certainly today's guest is right there with them. He's one of the greats of his business. Like one of our previous guests, George Steele, it's an interesting thing. He's best known to the casual fan for the tail end of his career when he was in the national spotlight in the WWF. That's really kind of unrepresentative. Really, the more you know about pro wrestling, the more you appreciate what this guy did, because his career really was defined on what he did in the NWA. He was probably the biggest pillar of the National Wrestling Alliance back in the 70s, and he holds the record in the territorial era of pro wrestling. Nobody ever held the world title on more different occasions than he did, 8 times. There have been folks who have had the NWA title more times than 8, but not all in the territorial era as he was, having to travel around from locale to locale and really having to be on top of many, many, many different territories at the same time as the unifying NWA World Heavyweight Champion. Subsequently, in the 90s, he managed Lex Luger and Big Van Vader when they were world champions in WCW. So he is a manager of champions also. And again, he also headlined the first real mega event in pro wrestling. And yes, kiddies, before WrestleMania, there was Starrcade. Starrcade 83, he was on top defending the title against the Nature Boy Ric Flair in what certainly went down as a classic. He is billed on his website as the best wrestler on God's green earth, and I would certainly concur with that. It's our pleasure to welcome to the program the legendary Harley Race. Harley, welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir. Pleasure to have you on.
Yes, bud, it's a pleasure being here with you. It's like always, any time that anyone being involved in wrestling as far and as long as I was, you get an opportunity to talk about it, you're thankful.
Well, actually, you talk about the depths of your involvement with it here. Let's start from that, Harley, because that really intrigues me, as I think it would anybody in the audience getting a chance to hear about it. I know that your roots really stretched to the carnival days back, I guess, around, what, the late 1950s, and that, to me, is fascinating because that's a part of the business that really stretches back to the earliest days of it. The carnivals around this time last century when pro wrestling really came to be what we know it as today. So what did you learn from the folks who had had that passed down to them over the years on the carnival circuit?
Well, be prepared for just about anything because you had no idea where it was coming from or how it was coming.
There's a very good reason, then, was there not, that back in those days, when you were learning the business, that Lou Thesz was the guy who was on top a good part of the time with the NWA, because, again, I think his book was called Shooter, you really had to be somebody, as you were, and you were reputed for this, I know, when you were going from territory to territory. That really was important, wasn't it, to be able to ward off against the double cross or something that might be coming politically?
Yeah, you had to be able to take care of yourself and back during that point in time. And it was a good thing because you never knew when you were going to be tested. You know, the odds of it happening were slim to none, but occasionally it would happen, and you had to be prepared for all that. That's why I, and I'm fairly sure Thez was the same way. Anything that happened in the ring virtually came from me calling it.
Well, that was, I know that was the tradition, certainly, with the champion going from territory to territory. So you had to be ready and able to do that. You had to be ready and able for, again, as you said, and correctly so, I mean, the odds of somebody pulling something were probably remote, but you had, I guess, have your guard up just in case. But what were some of the other things that went with that, Harley? Life on the road, particularly that stretch in the 70s into the 80s with being the traveling world champion, territory to territory. It's a very unique life, it seems to me, that it must be, being responsible for having to help keep up so many different territories at the same time.
Well, back during that era and time, not only were you, well, I was lucky enough to be able to fly to most of the places, which, again, you know, puts you through a lot of stuff because you were out there flying, going everywhere, and then once you got there, like going out for Don Owen, say, in Oregon, when you landed on the ground, you had seven straight nights you were wrestling, and a couple of hundred miles in between each little trip, and I always rented a vehicle and drove those miles myself, rather than wait for one of his guys or him or whoever he, you know, put there for, you know, to drive you around.
Mm-hmm.
I always did that driving myself, so that just added to the difficulty of being champion, right along with having to be able to go an hour whenever it was needed.
Well, that's true, because with going an hour, with doing the broadways as they came to be known, that's something I wanted to ask you about also, too, because you and Ric Flair are probably the most famous in the regard of being champion many times, going into an arena, a local arena, as the so-called heel in the situation, representing or going up against maybe the most popular guy in the promotion, their number one local guy. And the art form, really, in making that guy look great and still getting out of there with the title belt. It's just, to me, it's a fascinating balancing act, and it's one that if you're in that role, you have to be able to carry it off night after night after night. How do you keep your own credibility while leaving the guy that you're wrestling against looking better at the end of the night?
Well, actually, the better he looked, the better you would. When you beat him, and most generally the champion beats somebody, you know, the hours were, of course, were involved in it, but a lot of the times the champion beat most people.
Mm-hmm.
But being able to go an hour with anybody was a had to be.
That would be very challenging. That would be very, just, you know, in terms of the cardiovascular system and everything else that would go with that. And when you factor in all of the travel and everything else, leading up to what was the big match that we had referred to previously, the match with Ric Flair at Starrcade '83. You had detailed this in your book I had read a couple of years ago, about everything that went into that, the temptation of Vince McMahon coming into play with, because he had every interest at that point in time in breaking up that match, because he was about to take his own promotion national. So talk about the pressure of going into that situation of, first of all, the temptation of the offer from Vince, and also knowing that you were going to be tasked with really helping to cement Ric Flair and you know, make him the man for the next several years here. That match was going to be just so vitally important. So please talk about the thought process of everything that went into that night.
Well, there's where the honor and the trust system comes back into play. Had I have done what Vince wanted me to do at that point in time, sure, he would have liked it. But again, there would always have been that trust factor there with him. Well, whenever I want him to not be king of the ring, what happens if he doesn't want to be? It not only works as a reverse for you from the, you know, from the people who I was with at the time, but in the long run, it would have worked as a disadvantage to me from him also.
That's true. I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah, it's you really couldn't have a good two-way trust relationship out of a professional union that started in that kind of a way. That's an interesting thought there. I know that, again, you were I believe you were involved as a partner, were you not, with the St. Louis promotion, and I know that you were vitally involved in helping to promote in Kansas City also. I'm interested for your thoughts on the two different cities, because the reputation has always been St. Louis, just about the capital, the mecca of the wrestling world, all the big events that came into there. And Kansas City was always regarded, from everything I've seen, as a much more difficult place to draw. So I'm curious for what you think accounts for that. If it was differences in market size, attitudes of the local population, what made one area so highly regarded and the other one really come off as such a struggle to put good crowds in?
Well, run one, St. Louis only ran 18, maybe 20 shows a year.
Mm-hmm.
Kansas City ran 52 every week. And Sam had the pickings of the whole National Wrestling Alliance to get people into, because he was, at that point in time, president of the National Wrestling Alliance and pretty much called the shots on where the champion went. And it was just politically, it was just so much further ahead than Kansas City. And that held true until I become champion, because at that point in time, I also had an interest in the Kansas City promotion. So it became a lot easier to get the champion once I was their champion than it was beforehand.
It's interesting because Kansas City, that was something that you had mentioned in your book. I think it was in Kansas City where you made the visit, if you will, to the WWF folks when they came through town, when they were starting to promote there at that point in time. And that was, of course, in your latter days as a wrestler and promoter in that area. And subsequently, you would go on to join them. I'm very curious. I read in Jerry Lawler's book where he was talking about an incident of where the WWF was advertising that the King was going to be coming under their banner to Memphis and Nashville and some areas, of course, meaning you, but it was leading the local fans into thinking that he had joined the WWF. So he didn't mention that in any way of having any bad feelings towards you, but I'm just curious how wrestlers kind of regard one another under the circumstances. Is it something where if somebody else is working the same gimmick, is it just kind of a thing where wrestlers are like, oh, that guy's only doing what he's got to do? Or do hard feelings sometimes come into it if they feel that their own financial interests are threatened?
Well, of course, the hard feelings are going to come into it anytime you're threatened financially. I was just fortunate enough to be able to be pretty much at the right spots at the right point in time during that year, even though it was, you know, with McMahon coming in and taking the whole thing over with, I was pretty much through my run as being out there as world champion going to everywhere. So I could follow it up as King of the Ring going around to probably a third of the time that I would that I had to spend when I was out there as a world's champion. When you're wrestling as world's champion, you're going across the world and wrestling anybody and everybody, and two-thirds of the guys you were wrestling, you had to pretty much lead the thing and carry it totally along, or it wasn't going to come out right to start with. I don't know if that's what I'm saying, but...
Oh, no, I know exactly. And versus when you were in the WWF, that was a pretty star-studded crew and pretty experienced, and guys who'd really kind of made their bones, a lot of them like you, before they even got there in the first place, with the way that Vince was gobbling up the talent. You alluded to that as far as being King of the Ring and winning that tournament not long after you got there, and that was essentially sort of Vince's stand-in for acknowledging your past, because he never used the initials NWA. He never would have put you over as a seven-time world heavyweight champion or anything like that. So that was his way, clearly, everybody knows, of acknowledging your past and trying to leverage it but without being so blatant about it. I'm curious for your thoughts on the presentation of the King gimmick, because I know that in some instances when guys who've gone there and they've had some they've been business opponents, if you will, of Vince's previously, there's always thought about is Vince trying to pull a rib once he's got them working for him. Did you ever see any of that in the presentation of the character, from the very ornate purple robe and the crown to anything like that, or did you just see it as being a normal part of a royal gimmick?
No, I had the good fortunate opportunity to be the guy that chose that as I saw fit for it. And of course, being in that position, I wanted to present it as well as it could possibly be done, and I think I did a damn good job of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was it was very very rich colors. It looked I couldn't tell from TV exactly, but that thing looked like it was velvet or something very soft, that robe that you had. It looked like it was very comfortable, Harley.
Yeah, it was a very, very comfortable robe, and a very expensive one, because at that point in time, Vince was picking up what it cost, and I had it made, so I had the choice of making it how I wanted it, as the King would have had it.
That's beautiful. Money is no object when Vince is picking up the tab. I love that. But as far as that goes, you were a little bit, I guess it was under a year into the gimmick when you were coming up on this time of year. It was WrestleMania 6, of course, WrestleMania 3, and I'm just curious for your thoughts on this, because today, of course, all of the events that they have every year for WrestleMania are in the domed stadiums, or sometimes open air, as will be the case this year and next year. But regardless, crowds of that size, overwhelming atmosphere. Can you describe for our listeners what it's like to step out there on that kind of a stage and just have people as far as the eye can see?
You know, as being world's champion, I was in a lot of total sellouts in some pretty big buildings. Walking out there in front of 90-plus thousand people was just, totally unreal. And being able to perform in front of an audience like that and keeping them involved in what you were doing was great, and I thought I did a pretty damn good job of that. Being involved in that type of an atmosphere was phenomenal.
Absolutely. And going out there and having an entertaining match with Junkyard Dog and going through all of that with him, and him being one of the big regional draws of the era before he came there, it was just really entertaining to see the two of you squaring off on the big stage there. Subsequently to that, when you moved on from the WWF and into WCW. I'm curious for what the approach was as far as being the in-ring manager of Lex Luger and then Big Van Vader. I mean, I know that, and I think most people know that a lot of times it may just be image as far as a promoter putting together wrestlers and a manager, and but sometimes it goes deeper than that, and sometimes there are real life connections. It always seemed to me, and from everything I've ever seen and things that I've heard people say, that there really was a kind of a connection with you, with Luger, and then subsequently Vader, in terms of helping them and tutoring them on being the top guy in the promotion and what it takes to be on top and how you present yourself as champion. Were you that involved in the mentoring role with these guys when you were put together with them?
Well, somewhat so, yes. People like that, of course, have got their own opinions, and if they got any, you know what, they're going to make sure that some of their opinion comes through in it. I was able to do it because of the respect that those guys had for me and what I had done for so many years in front of them. So it was kind of a flip of a coin, but we managed to work it out where it worked good for both sides.
It did look like it was a good situation as far as how those guys came along and progressed and developed into that role. I'm curious what you made of it when Big Van Vader went on top, coming over from Japan. You having had extensive experience in Japan also, you know, you had pretty much made your bones in America before you went over there, and he pretty much got to the level that he was at in working in Japan and then coming to America and establishing himself in WCW. Well, what are some of the more important things that wrestlers will pick up when they're over there in the Japanese promotions, whether they're somebody who's already established like you or somebody like Vader who's making his reputation while he's there?
Well, the you know, kind of all falls back to how you or yourself is personally respected there. And I had all the respect in the world, and I treated them with the same type, and I made them look like they could beat the champion at any point in time, and they knew I was going to do that. So it was just a way of doing things that was different than what other guys could do, because they hadn't, you know, they hadn't held the title.
Well, I know it worked very well for you, because I know how highly you were regarded in Japan and how successful those stretches you were. I know that you were in the that first real big wave of Americans that really kind of made it over there and could go over there and have that kind of credibility on a regular basis. But as far as everything that you learned in your career, whether it be Japan, going back to the roots and the carnivals, everything like that, specifically, I know that you've got the Race Wrestling Academy going as we kind of turn to present day here and some of your activities. What are some of the precepts that you consider to be the most important as you're teaching these guys now? Because we've seen a very welcome, I think, back to basics kind of a movement right now, where guys like CM Punk and Daniel Bryan can be successful, and they're guys that seem to embody a lot of the things that you did when you were on top. What do you find to be the principles that are most important to teach this younger generation of guys?
To be able to go in that ring and come out of there with having a classic match with anybody that you're sent in there to have it with. That isn't an easy task by any means, and there's a select group of people in the world that can do it. Or, hell, we would all be in there.
Mm-hmm. But, well, it's definitely something to aspire to. I mean, if guys aren't aiming to be at that level, then they have no chance of making it in the first place. But as far as everything that's going on there, I know that you've got the academy going where you're teaching the guys, and also the WLW World League Wrestling promotion also. Talk about that for a second, if you will. Some of the promotional thoughts that you have, some of the things you try to get across with that promotion.
Well, I try to get across the Harley Race philosophy of what I have done all my life. This is the only job I've ever had and the only job I've ever wanted. When you go out there with that in mind, it's fairly easy for you to be able to move forward with what you're doing and bring it around to where the people will accept it and respect you and have a great time while they're there.
Well, that's all anybody could ever ask for, and a chance to get to go to a show that is promoted by Harley Race, and with everything that you've learned over the decades and poured into it. Certainly, the hub for any of this stuff would be, of course, at harleyrace.com. It's got plenty of information there, of course, on WLW and the Race Wrestling Academy. Take a minute here, sir. Anything that we really didn't cover in enough detail thus far, and anything else that people should know about what you've got going on and what some of your plans are?
No, just that every show that I run is a benefit for something. No matter what town it is in the 4 or 5 state area that I run here in the Midwest, anytime we're in that town, all that money doesn't leave town with me. 30 to 40% of it goes to benefit whatever organization that I'm running the show for there at the time.
Excellent. Well, God bless you, sir, because that's a great that's another dimension to giving back, really, too. I mean, giving back to this generation that's coming up, trying to teach them the principles of the business and how to be successful in it, and then the philosophy of giving back to the communities that are supporting the promotion. That's a tremendous thing. I certainly hope that all of our listeners will keep up with everything here at harleyrace.com. And all I can say, sir, is that we so much appreciate the chance to talk to you here today about your great career, everything that you've had going on. We'd love to have you back anytime. We thank you so much.
And it's always an honor to be able to talk to the people.
Excellent. Well, thank you, sir. The great Harley Race, everyone. We appreciate having had him on. This is FDH Lounge, mini episode number 88. Thank you for tuning in.